court will now take up our last case on the docket. That is the case of Philip Hodling against ID Confirm Incorporated. Ms. Kelly.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Nora Kelly. I'm appearing here today for Philip Hodling, the plaintiff appellant in the case. Our appeal today, Your Honors, is an appeal of a judgment against Mr. Hodling on his claim for breach of contract. It was a claim of breach of an agreement that he had with defendant ID Confirm. And his claim of breach was that there wasn't compliance with a provision in the agreement requiring that if ID Confirm wished to terminate the agreement for a performance reason, it must first provide him notice and a right to cure, in a period of right to cure.
Ms. Kelly, can you help me out here on what exactly is the agreement we're talking about? Because we have the consultant agreement and the contractor agreement, both of which may have expired or may not have. And I guess I'm not even clear on what the agreement is we're talking about. I don't think we can just pick the language we like. What is your position as to what was the controlling agreement at the time in question?
Well, it's the independent contractor agreement, Your Honor. That's Exhibit B, our Exhibit A.
Now, why?
Our Exhibit 1.
So, but why is that the agreement as opposed to the consulting agreement?
Because Exhibit B pertains to Mr. Hodling acting as an independent contractor as the United States Markets Business Development Manager to develop sales in the United States domestic markets. And that's in paragraph 1 of Exhibit B.
But Exhibit A kind of covers the same territory. And I guess you're, if I remember this right, your colleague says the reason the party signed both is because they both showed up with their own favorite version of a contract and they liked pieces, so they signed them both.
Yeah. Well, actually, Exhibit A does not cover the same territory. It has, for one thing, it has a different name. It's engagement as an independent consultant. It defines what Mr. Hodling was to do, and it's not the most artfully drafted agreement, so it's a little bit difficult to discern exactly what it addresses, but it does provide under paragraph 2 that Mr. Hodling was going to become an independent sales and marketing consultant to ID Confirm, and that under 5, Mr. Hodling, 5B, Hodling and such other parties as may become independent sales and marketing consultants will jointly prepare a proposal for ID Confirm as to additional compensation, such as a sales commission, residual plan, and so forth.
Paragraph 5 also says he gets paid $85,000 annually, which works out the same in Exhibit B in the contractor agreement. There it's listed as twice a month, but they both came out the same. I don't think your position is he was entitled to $85,000 under each. Let me back up. Maybe I should ask you this. Is it accurate that they signed these at the same time?
On the same day.
Okay.
Yeah, they both have the same date. But the defendant, ID Confirm, has not to date cited a case wherein it says that just because two agreements are signed on the same date that they merge. And that was not the case here. And as we pointed out in Exhibit B, the independent contractor's agreement, the controlling agreement, it does clearly state in paragraph 13 that it's the final agreement.
So, counsel, if the independent contractor agreement controls and the other one does not, what is the consequence of that? What are we to gain from that?
Well, what you're to gain, Your Honor, is paragraph 8, and that is what Mr. Hotelling filed his breach of contract case on.
Okay.
It was paragraph 8 because it sets out when the agreement can be terminated, under what circumstances, and what has to take place before that. And Mr. Hotelling's contention was that that did not take place before Exhibit B, the independent contractor agreement, was terminated.
So your position, Ms. Kelly, is there was no 9-month term on this agreement?
Exactly.
There's a 9-month term in Exhibit A, the consulting agreement, but not in Exhibit B.
Yes, exactly. And Mr. Hotelling testified without dispute, I would say, at trial, that his understanding of Exhibit A was that it covered his bringing in other people to sell the ID Confirm product, that ID for You product. And if you look down at paragraph 8 in Exhibit A, the non-controlling agreement, it says, Phil Hotelling shall provide such services to ID Confirm as would be expected of a person initially developing a, it should read a, sales and marketing program, including but not limited to the development of a compensation plan for non-ID Confirm purveyors of ID Confirm equipment and services. Results of such services, including such distributors, resellers, or marketing joint ventures resulting from Phil Hotelling services, shall become the property of ID Confirm. And so the relevance of Exhibit A, the independent consultant agreement, is just that it does have that 9-month period. And defendant ID Confirm argued that because both Exhibit A and Exhibit B were signed the same day, that 9-month period then also pertains to the independent contractor agreement.
Didn't your client agree that the term had expired and they were negotiating for an employment contract and he didn't want it and he agreed that he was at will?
No, he did not agree. He presented testimony that Mr. Morrison, one of the, or the other defendant, had come to him and offered to make him an employee, but that ultimately it was decided that wouldn't be in Mr. Hotelling's best interest. But I, at trial, asked both Mr. Morrison, Mr. Breen, if they had ever told Mr. Hotelling that they didn't consider the independent contractor agreement no longer in place, as they would have been required to do. And they both said no, they never said that to him. So it was still in place as of the time of his termination.
Counsel, what did the trial court find then with respect to these two contracts? Did it find, as a matter of fact, that they merged?
The trial court did, yes.
Oh, okay.
The trial court adopted the proposed findings and fact and conclusions of law and judgment that was submitted by the defendant, ID Confirm, and Mr. Morrison, with only about 2 or 3 changes, just
now,
pretty much signed off on it.
Now, I take it your position is that in finding that they merged, as opposed to finding just that the one agreement controls over the other, that was a mistake. It was a clear error?
By the trial court, yes.
Can you explain to me why that's so?
Well, because of the fact of the two agreements, the trial court apparently looked to what Mr. Morrison claimed was the intent of the parties. Mr. Hotelling never testified that he thought they were both merging or part of the whole one agreement. But Mr. Morrison said that that's what he thought. And our position is that if it's clear in the agreement, unless it's unclear, that you can't bring in evidence of, you know, to that's to the contrary of what it states in the agreement. And it clearly states under paragraph 13 that this is the agreement, the final agreement.
Well, it says it supersedes prior negotiations. It doesn't mm-hmm. talk about contemporaneous or subsequent documents. They signed two documents mm-hmm. at the same time. And so I'm not sure that the merger clause actually gets rid of the independent consulting agreement, but I'd be happy to hear your argument to the contrary.
What merger clause, Your Honor?
Paragraph 13. It says this is the final agreement, supersedes all prior negotiations, understandings, and agreements, written or oral. That's a typical merger clause, integration clause,
yes,
et cetera. Uh-huh. But here they signed these two documents at the same time. And so I'm not sure that that provision necessarily gets you out of it's an easy answer to get you out of the question here as to why we ignore the first.
Well, our argument would be that it does get us out of question. I don't know of any case that says just because two agreements are signed at the same time that there's any question of them that they therefore merge. You can use one agreement to interpret the other agreement. That's our claim. And if it was the case that the two agreements were supposed to be interpreted together, I would think that the parties as sophisticated business persons could have written something in there or done something to show. And again, Your Honor, our claim is that they really address two different things. That the independent consultant.
Your position is they're both in effect for a while, but the one sort of terminated by its terms after 9 months and leaving this one.
Exactly,
controlling.
Yes.
Now, the trial court, if I recall correctly, found in part on the basis of the nine-month provision, but then made some other findings about paragraph 8 as to why that wouldn't be necessarily a problem here. Can you address those findings and tell me what your position is?
Okay. Findings.
In other words, the court felt that there was notice and an opportunity to cure.
Oh, yes.
The court made that finding.
Yes. I understand. Okay. Yes, and our argument is that there wasn't notice. Again, we're dealing with a contract, not just an informal agreement, but this is a contract that sets out what has to be done as far as notice. I mean, it's specific about that. That was not followed here. Now, defendant, ID Confirm, has claimed that Exhibit AA, a memo to Mr. Hotelling, was notice. That was not actually what was claimed at the trial. I asked Mr. Morrison if his intent was to provide the notice, and he said no. And but Exhibit AA cannot serve as the notice of right to cure for two reasons. One is it's not the kind that's required under the party's agreement.
How?
It doesn't say that it's a notice of right to cure under the agreement so that Mr. Hotelling knows what it is. It doesn't follow the agreement. Under the agreement, there's a 5-day cure period, and Exhibit AA doesn't give a 5-day cure period.
Days.
It gave 60 days, yes.
So you're saying unless it was exactly 5 days, it doesn't comply? If it gives him more, it doesn't comply?
Well, it did give him more. Now, they didn't follow that 60 days.
No, but they went well beyond 5 days.
They went beyond 5 days, but Mr. Hotelling didn't know that, and he, of course, denies that he ever got Exhibit AA, but he didn't know that Exhibit AA was that notice of right to cure, and therefore he wasn't able to then provide the cure. Instead, we have this long period of time after the date of the memo before he was fired. The date of the memo, I think it was April 13th. And he was fired on May 25th. And nobody provided really much at the trial. Mr. Hotelling did. We went through what he was doing that whole time. but it wasn't, if he had been given the proper notice of right to cure, then he could have given a response to the right to cure and said, no, here are the customer lists, or here.
He was asked for that. I mean, I don't. I don't know if it's your position. Mm-hmm. Is it your position that he had no idea that the ID was upset with his performance? They were all over him, as I understand the record, saying he didn't produce one sale in 15 months. Didn't he have plenty of actual notice that there was a real problem here?
Actually, he testified that he was shocked when he was terminated. He thought that he was doing a good job. And in fact, that very morning, he had been talking to a potential customer. But there's nothing in Exhibit AA about the customer list. There's a criticism that they weren't pleased with the customer list that he had already provided. But in that last paragraph of Exhibit A, it doesn't say we need a customer list within 60 days or you're out of here.
I know your time's about up. Let me ask you quickly, though. Assuming for argument's sake that the contracts went to at will here, that they expired and that the district judge's right were at will, does the notice and opportunity to cure provision still apply in that context? We're now in the contracts have expired by their terms, we're in an at-will world. Is it your position the notice and opportunity to cure provision still applies?
Well, my position would be that the fact that there was the provision for a notice and opportunity for right to cure would mean that it was not an at-will contract. Because if it's an at-will contract, there would be no right to cure.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Compton.
Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Patrick Compton, 34425, on behalf of defendants ID Confirm and Robert Morrison. I think what we're dealing with here is a dissatisfied plaintiff who had his day and he had his opportunity in court and in trial. He not only had an opportunity to present 2 days' worth of trial testimony, but he also had the opportunity to submit countless post-trial motions to a new judge, no less, because there was a change in divisions after this case was tried to Judge Rappaport. And now he's dissatisfied with the result, and he wants another opportunity to retry this case. And although he has many arguments, none of those warrant reversal. I think with respect to the issue of whether or not we have two agreements, I mean, certainly the most important thing about contract interpretation is to comport with the intent of the parties and find out what the parties intended. And here that's what we have. We have two agreements that cover the same engagement. Each side brought one to the table. They signed them up on the same day because they both liked what was contained within them and liked parts of each. Was that the best business practice for either side? Probably not. I'm sure they regret some of that because that's what's led us here today in part. But in reality, that doesn't destroy the intent of the parties. Now, with respect to the term of duration, certainly there's plenty of case law out there that says that the trial court can accept extrinsic evidence on those issues and supply the terms of the contract, supply additional terms of contracts, including terms of duration, through that process, through accepting parole evidence. In fact, one case, and albeit it's not selected for official publication, I'll tell the court, but it's so directly on point, I should point it out, that's the Buckner v. Rouse case. That's 538 P2D 117, and it says the court could certainly accept parole evidence and supply terms of duration in that respect. But I think you can put aside all of the issues with respect to the contract, with respect to its terms, with respect to expiration, all of the arguments that are made there, because the damages element, the damages issue trial hasn't been presented on appeal. And the district court expressly found that Mr. Hotelling didn't meet his burden of proof with respect to damages. And that alone is enough to affirm the district court's conclusion. Similarly, there's the issue of incurability. Now that's something that wasn't addressed, to slightly addressed, I should say, on appeal, but not aggressively addressed. And And it makes a whole lot of sense. As Judge Gabriel said, he was unable to develop a sale in 15 months. It's not likely that he could have done it within 5 days. And in fact, he conceded as much at trial. And I think that's very telling. In the court, the trial court has discretion on that issue. The trial court, we have to defer it. Was it clearly erroneous for the trial court to make that conclusion? I would submit no. In fact, I'd submit that's the only right outcome. If he wasn't able to develop a sale in 5 days, in 15 months, he wasn't going to be able to do that in 5 days. Now, with respect to the other claims that were submitted on appeal,
I'm sorry, Mr. Counsel, sure. Before you go on, sure. On this notice and opportunity to cure issue, do you concede that there was an obligation to give notice to him?
I don't think after the initial 9 months expired that there was. And the reason why is because the parties agreed that it wasn't required. Mr. Hotelling conceded at trial in his testimony that he didn't believe that if he was to terminate the engagement of the parties after 9 months, that he would have to provide notice and a right to cure. And so I think the answer to that is no, Your Honor.
All right, but is it your position that notwithstanding that you gave notice anyway?
Well, our position is we gave him notice and an ample opportunity to cure because we wanted him to do the job. I confirmed after repeated requests, had this meeting, and it's addressed in the record, this meeting of I believe it was April 3rd, where they brought Mr. Hotelling in and said, you need to develop sales or you're going to be terminated. Now, his testimony on that flip-flopped through depositions, but he ultimately conceded on cross-examination at trial that, yes, he was told in that meeting, he was given notice that he needed to develop a sale or that he was going to be terminated. And so not only was he given that notice and given an opportunity to cure for the next 45 days, he was given Exhibit AA. He denies receiving it. But the fact of the matter is the trial court, reviewing the record, decided that, in fact, he had been given that exhibit. Given to him personally. And there was other evidence, in fact, to suggest that he had. But we don't need to rehash all the record on that point. The fact is, he was given more than adequate opportunity to cure. He failed to do so, and he was ultimately terminated. And, you know, that's the Hemberger decision, and I think it makes a whole lot of sense that if you're given more than the requisite opportunity to cure, you admit that you were given that opportunity to cure, and the simple fact is there's some procedural nuance that you didn't comply with by the terms of an agreement. The courts aren't going to look at that and hold that against the party who gave notice. Now, I could go through the other issues, but I've just asked the court at this juncture. I think the briefs speak for themselves. If there are any specific questions that you'd like me to answer, I'd be glad to do so.
I guess I had a couple.
Sure.
On the non-disclosure agreement, what language are you relying on?
Sure.
I mean, you want a judgment here for breach of the non-disclosure agreement.
Yes.
What specific language are you relying on?
Sir.
Shows a breach.
Within paragraph 2 of the non-disclosure agreement, It discusses that the disclosee agrees that any and all work product technology and other additional information relating or applicable to said information that is developed, generated, or otherwise contributed by Mr. Hotelling in connection with his consideration of the information disclosed by disclosure will be owned by the disclosure.
So you would say the customer information is that other additional information, et cetera?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And more than that, there was parole evidence offered by both parties on this issue. And it was presented at trial. And the district court, relying on the parole evidence, looked at it and said it makes perfect sense that the customer information is information developed by, generated by, and contributed by the plaintiff in furtherance of ID confirmed business enterprise.
And the breach here, as I understand it, is that Mr. Hotelling did not provide this information when requested?
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, as I read paragraph 2, it specifically says he has to deliver to your client all materials comprising any information disclosed by your client. That's there expressly. So if your client gave him, you know, whatever information, he has to give it back on request. Interestingly, it doesn't seem to cover that other information. There's no provision that says he has to give you that on request. And I guess you'd read in, hey, since it's ours, if we ask, we get it. But the language, you're shaking in your head, I think you understand what I'm getting at. It's interesting that the language of this document specifically provides for when he has to give up certain information, but it doesn't address this information you're talking about. Would you respond to that?
And absolutely, Judge Gabriel. I think that's something that not only implied by the terms of the contract, but that was something that was discussed with respect to parole evidence. And it is, as you mentioned, it perfectly comports with the intent of the parties that if something is owned by another party, that you have to give that to them upon their reasonable request. And part of, obviously, the enforcement of this agreement is getting that information from the plaintiff.
Yeah, and I just have one other question that I promise I'll shut up. Is it accurate that the district court awarded Mr. Morrison fees sua sponte, that the court raised that on its own?
I don't think that's completely accurate. Did the court make the determination that ID Confirm was entitled to attorney's fees at trial as part of its order and judgment? The answer to that question is yes. But was the issue discussed, argued, raised during the district court trial? The answer to that is yes, too. The parties were discussing, we were arguing the issues associated with the fact that Mr. Hotelling's claim against Mr. Morrison lacked a substantial justification.
All right, so Mr. Hotelling had notice that issue was on the table before the court awarded fees?
Absolutely, and even more so, Your Honor, I would say if there was any question as to whether he did or not, the simple fact is the district court in its order directed us to submit a bill of fees, which we did. At that point in time, Mr. Hotelling objected to our fees and included arguments objecting to our, including arguments not only objected to the amount of our attorney's fees, but also to the entitlement to attorney's fees. He also raised that as an issue in his motion for reconsideration. And at all points in time, once again, a second set of eyes looked at the record, decided on reconsideration, deciding on the issues with respect to our bill of fees, that there was no error on it.
And did Mr. Hotelling ask for a hearing on the fees issue?
He did not. He did not ask for a hearing with respect to the attorney's fees submitted by Mr. Morrison for the claim that was substantially groundless, substantially vexatious.
Thanks.
Mr. Compton, I have a couple of questions regarding the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing claim.
Yes, sir.
And specifically the damages on that claim.
Yes, Your Honor.
It appears to me that the theory was that the covenant was breached because of Mr. O'Talling's failure to provide the customer information. Is that right?
Yes, it is.
Okay. The damages awarded were equal to the amount that the company had paid Mr. O'Talling.
Yes.
I'm having a hard time figuring out how those are logically damages flowing from the failure to turn over customer lists. It seems to me that customer lists have a value. That value is those are potential clients. And it is possible in cases I've seen to value that. But I've never seen a case that says, well, the value of that is what we paid in salary. How is there a logical connection there?
Sure, and I think the way that you address that is first, one, we should think and consider the trial courts, the trial court's discretion on that particular issue, because I think that's important to note, that what the trial court is tasked with doing is in sitting as trier of fact is, one, to determine whether or not there are any damages, whether or not there is an entitlement, and thereafter, whether or not there's any reasonable computation. And so I think in addressing your question, we have to look and decide, was that a reasonable computation? And the reason I would say the answer to that is yes, is because the implied breach of good faith and fair dealing is a contract claim. At its essence, it necessarily imports or imparts additional terms into a contract. And the contract, the consideration paid for that very contract was what Mr. Hotelling was paid, you know, over the course of his tenure with ID Confirm. And that's where I think the damage is lined up.
But the measure of contract damages is to put the party back in the position that it would have been in had there been no breach.
Certainly, Your Honor, but there's also rescissionary damages. There's also additional damages theories that you can pursue with respect to a contract claim. And I agree with the court with respect to expectancy damages that you could look at it and say, well, were there additional damage theories that ID Confirm could have pursued? Could it have looked at potential lost profits over that 9-month period of time that it took it to get back up and running? Certainly, but it didn't need to because it had this reasonable computation.
Well, it sounds to me like you're saying that so long as there was any breach of the contract, regardless of the nature of the breach, then IE Confirm could just throw out a damages theory that would support damages under another different kind of breach, and that would be okay. I mean, I'm having trouble with that. You have a finding here of a particular kind of breach. The damages have to reasonably relate to that particular kind of breach.
Sure.
How does whatever salary was paid serve as a proxy for the value of customer lists?
Well, and I think the answer to that specific question is that it serves as a proxy because it's what he was paid to do. He was paid to generate that customer information.
He was paid to do a lot of other things. I mean, he was paid to generate sales. He wasn't just paid to make lists. And yet, that's the only breach that was found here under this claim. He didn't turn over the list, okay? So he's paid to do a whole bunch of things. That's the $126,000 he's paid. And you're essentially saying we can equate, we paid him $126,000 to make a list.
Well, and I appreciate that. And I think the answer is, and I see where you're going, the fact is the customer information was needed for the next step of what he was supposed to do under the contract, which is develop sales. And so he never developed sales. He never produced the customer information. The customer information is what ID Confirm needed to have to get to that next step of developing sales with or without the service.
Did you produce any evidence that would provide a basis for valuing the customer lists? Do we have some expert testimony or something that would say this is what we think the list would have been worth?
No, Your Honor, it was the testimony of the parties. We had a bailment claim, and as I recall, because obviously the difference under a bailment as opposed to a breach of contract are different standards, but as I recall, the witnesses did testify with respect to the customer information as having a value equal to the amount that was paid Mr. Hotelling under that theory. But we didn't prevail on that particular claim, and I just can't recall.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That will conclude our arguments for the afternoon. Court thanks both counsel.